I'm Eric Kaufman, and welcome to the second installment of the Integration Conversation here at the Integration Hub of Policy Exchange. I'm here with Conrad Hackett of Pew, who's just come over from Washington. Today we're going to be talking about the demography of religion, and just for the viewers, this is important in my view because it sort of sets an environment in which the whole integration debate is taking place. That is, which ethnic groups and religions are growing in the world, but also in Britain and Europe, and how does that affect relations, ethnic relations, religious relations within countries? And so this idea of understanding the population shifts and flows in the world and their connection to cultural groups is central, I think, to getting a big picture view, bird's eye view on the integration debate. So Conrad, maybe you could start by telling us a bit about your position at Pew.
Sure. I work in the Religion Project at Pew Research Center. We're in Washington, D.C. We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit research group, and I'm the leader of our religious demography team at Pew.
Great. And I should say that I have presented to the Religious Demography Unit, and they are a first-class organization. The other thing I should say also is a bit of background. I first met Conrad when he was just wrapping up his PhD over at University of Texas. So that was quite fortuitous. I think I was there to give a talk, and then somehow we got in touch.
That's right. I was actually doing a postdoc at Texas.
Oh, postdoc, sorry.
Which is a great place to spend some time, and I got my degree in New Jersey.
Right, and I really loved the dissertation, which was all about the religiosity and fertility,
yes,
focusing on the U.S., but that certainly chimed with a lot of what I was looking at the time. So I want to kind of begin then with the Pew, of course, does, I mean, maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of the work they do on simply collecting the data, some of the methodology on how you arrive at this idea of what's going on in the world with religion.
Yes, so many countries around the world collect data that includes information on religious identity. That has happened here in the UK in 2011 and 2001. In India, they have the world's largest religious data collection, asking over 1 billion people their religion. In the US, we don't. We have to rely on large surveys in the US. So what our team does is we go through every country in the world and find the best data on religion. We standardize that, we aggregate it, and then we can put reports out describing what the big picture is, because it's just too much work for most people to try to assimilate all this disparate information.
Right, and so two things that jump out, I think, and for the viewers, one of those will be the question of Islam in Europe, Islam in the United Kingdom. What is the size and growth trajectory of Islam going forward, and also in the world? Secondly, this issue of secularization, how secular is Europe and Britain and now the United States going to become? So these are some of the questions that I want to sort of pull at in this.
Sure.
Conrad will be right up to the minute on all this data. So first of all, I guess a big topic is Islam in Europe. What do we know from the Pew data, which I think is the gold standard on this, in terms of the current size of the Muslim share of Europe, and then where that's going to be going to 2050?
Well, the distinct thing about Muslims around the world is that they tend to have more children and be younger than the non-Muslim population in most countries. And that's true here in Europe as well. So we estimate that between 2010 and 2015, among Christians, there were more deaths than there were births. But that was not true for Muslims. Muslim numbers grew significantly during that period just from having more children than deaths to Muslims. And part of that's because it's largely a young immigrant population. But furthermore, about 60% of the growth was due to immigration alone. And of course, around 2015, we had a large influx of Muslims coming seeking refugee status in many European countries. And so that had a particularly big effect on Germany and Sweden and some other large receiving countries. In the UK, a lot more Muslims come through regular migration channels seeking employment or education.
And just in terms of the top line numbers, say, for Britain, in terms of what is the current proportion Muslim in Britain, and what are we looking at in terms of the median projections for 2050?
Sure. Our estimate was that in 2016, about 6% of the UK population was Muslim, and that if there were no further migration afterwards, just as a result of being younger and having higher fertility, that by 2050, the Muslim share of the UK population would rise to about 10%. With ongoing migration, regular migration, we think it would be something like 17%. And if there was a regular, similar flow of refugees as we've seen in recent years, it'd be a little bit higher. The UK hasn't absorbed as many Muslim refugees as some other European countries. But in any case, through the combination of fertility and migration, we expect a significant growth of the Muslim population.
And looking at Western Europe, I mean, I remember seeing the numbers for Sweden. Sweden seems to have the fastest rate of increase, am I correct? So something like 20% in 2050, is that right?
So the thing about Sweden is it's a relatively small population right. That's been very welcoming to refugees in recent years. And so the eye-popping number from our report was that if you had that record levels of refugees being accepted in Sweden continuing for the next few decades at the same rate we saw during this unusual 2015-2016 period, then we could get to slightly north of 30% of Sweden's population being Muslim. Now, to be clear, we don't have any reason to think this is likely. This is an extreme scenario with an ongoing, very generous, welcoming policy and a steady stream of refugees coming. And recent circumstances since we put that report out don't provide any reason to think that that's going to be the likely future. So this is kind of a way to put in perspective some of the sensational claims that are out there that some countries in Europe might have a Muslim majority right. In the coming decades. Even in our highest projection scenarios, we don't see that. So we do see steady growth, but we don't see this Eurabia scenario that some people talk about.
Right, right. And so if we take, say, the median projection for, say, Sweden, Germany, particularly the Netherlands, I mean, a number of these countries, can you give us some sort of rough ballpark numbers? It seemed to me that it was somewhere in the neighborhood 15 to 20% for those, for the sort of main immigrant receiving Western European countries
yeah.
in 2050. I mean, I don't need to mean to sort of put you on the spot in terms of actual numbers, but.
Well, I'm just going to turn to my okay. report so I give you the
actual
numbers.
Which is all online,
numbers.
By the way.
That's right. And so, yes. It's called Europe's Growing Muslim Population, and right. we describe our methodology and sources in great detail. So, in the scenario where migration continues more or less as normal, separating aside refugee flows, we project that by 2050, Germany would be about 11% Muslim, France would be about 18%, Sweden would be about 20%,
okay.
for example. Right. And so the countries that receive a lot more regular migrants are those that would grow the most in those scenarios.
And just on that, I was going to actually ask about, I mean, I do know some of the people who are involved, of course, in these projections, but what in terms of the religious switching assumptions on that, I mean, what do we know about, do we know anything about Muslim switching to non-religion, rates of that in different countries, or is that pretty frontier in terms of research?
Well, that's a great question. And so when we put this report out, we got a lot of questions along these lines, and also people noting that what it means to be Muslim can vary tremendously, and asking us questions, how do you measure Muslim identity? So, first of all, we're just relying on how people describe their own religion. Wherever we have something like a UK census that gives people that opportunity, when we're looking at the religion of immigrants, in some cases we have to assume that if someone's coming from Morocco to Spain, they're probably Muslim because right. almost everybody in Morocco identifies as such. In terms of switching, we have a very good survey in France that asked French people what religion they grew up in and their religion today. And in that survey, which had a large number of Muslims and did a really good job, about 10% of people who grew up Muslim no longer identified as such. And in most other Western European countries, we just don't have the same kind of survey data about the changing religious identity of Muslims. So we assumed that in Western European countries, about 10% of people who are raised Muslim would no longer identify as such as adults.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. Because I guess I'm of the view that it varies quite a bit, right? Because
yes.
I know in the UK, I mean, and this is not something I, you know, I was poking around the ONS mm-hmm. longitudinal survey, which is a 1%
yeah. right.
tracked sample of the census, to see how many Muslims in 2001 reported themselves as not religious in 2011, and vice versa.
Yeah.
And you can certainly see that the share, the movement is pretty small. I mean, there's four times more movement out of Islam as opposed to into Islam from non-religion, but it's still, I mean, quite small. But I think that's partly, you know, partly due to the low intermarriage of you know, South Asian Muslims.
Yes.
Whereas I think in France, some of the numbers that I've heard around outmarriage is sort of 40-50% amongst Algerians and Moroccans. So that could affect the picture down the road, perhaps.
Yes, absolutely. And it also, what are the sending countries? So European countries that are receiving a lot of Iranians may have more people who no longer identify as Muslim than the UK, where you have a lot of South Asian
right,
immigrants.
Right. Yeah, so it's one to watch in terms of data sources. Good. All right. So I think it's good coverage on Europe. Do we want to say anything in terms of Britain? Anything that that jumps out at you about Britain from the numbers, whether it be about Islam or even this, we can get on to secularization, but yeah.
Well, the interesting thing about Britain and Western Europe in general, when you talk about religious identity, is for those people who are raised from a Christian background, the numbers that emerge really vary a lot depending on how you ask the question. We did a recent survey in Western Europe, and we found that something like 90% in a typical country say they were baptized as Christian. And then the share who say they were raised Christian is a little bit lower, maybe 80%. And then the share who still identify as Christian is lower still. And then you ask about practice, and the share who actually go to worship services on a regular basis is very low.
Right.
So you can kind of pick any different number there to say Christian identity is very high in Europe. If you think about this sort of natalist, baptized identity, or what might come up in a kind of reactionary sense, if people feel like their identity is threatened by religious others, maybe they're more likely to say they're Christian. But a lot of surveys in Europe, as you know, ask first kind of a filtering question, you know, do you have a religion? Do you consider yourself to be religious? And then, if so, what is your religion? And when that kind of question is posed, that's when you get numbers that less than half of people in Britain identify as Christian, for example.
Right, right. Okay, okay. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned about Christian identity being higher where there's a growing other religion. And we definitely see that in a number of different British studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so in areas where there's a higher Muslim share.
Yeah.
A larger share of the white British population identifies as Christian, which is quite interesting, actually.
Sure.
So more people in England identify as Christian than in Scotland, if I'm not mistaken. Scotland has very few ethnic minorities. England has more. So I think this is partly this cultural defense mechanism you're talking about. Whether that translates into, I mean, we know it maybe translates into things such as support for populism, but it's not clear whether it does translate into, say, higher practice in those areas where there's a larger, say, Muslim share in the town.
Right. Yeah, one thing we found in our survey in Western Europe was that people who identify as Christian are more likely than people who don't identify with religion to embrace nationalist sentiments, to feel like their country is superior to others.
Right.
So
But on the other hand, I think that all the surveys I've seen have, and I think Jim Guth at Furman has mm-hmm. done work on this, that the ones who attend regularly are significantly less likely to vote populist right.
Okay.
So it's the nominal identifiers who are more likely, but the
right.
regular attenders are less likely, which is kind of interesting because it suggests there's a difference between that identity function and then the actual otherworldly spiritual function of religion, which is kind of interesting. In terms of, I just wonder if you could tell us a bit about this whole, the question, will religion more or less decline in Christian Europe? I mean, do you think is it headed for the scrap heap? What's your sort of long-term view on this?
That's a great question. One thing that's clear is in every country in the world, there's at least a substantial minority of the population that's still pretty religious. And we don't really have any reason to know that will cease to be the case in any given country. So the question is, you know, how long will this pattern of declining religious identity continue for? And we don't really know the answer. It's a good question, but what I find particularly intriguing is the question of what's happening in countries where most people are highly religious, or at least almost everyone identifies with religion. In those countries, will they follow a trajectory that we see in places like Western or Eastern Europe, or might religion continue to be very resilient? So I'm thinking of Africa in particular. There's some countries like South Africa where a significant share in the 2001 census said they had no religion. The data is kind of mixed about what's happened since then, but it's not clear that the country is becoming less religious.
And I just on that, I mean, the whole question of coming back to Britain for a second, this
sure.
issue of cultural defense, I just want to talk about for a minute, because in London, we're sitting in we are sitting in the hotspot of religion in
yes,
Britain.
Yes, sure.
And as you probably, well, we both probably have studied in this area that you know, essentially people who are religious tend to have more children. Mm-hmm. Tend that the parts of the world that are religious are the parts of the world producing pretty well all the population growth and most of the sources for immigrants
yes,
in the
right.
world. So we have London as a place where you have religious people arriving into a relatively secular society. Mm-hmm. And so religiosity is growing in London. I mean, what are your thoughts on this demographic pattern and how, because the other thing you see on the census here is that even African Christians, for example, have very limited shift to non-religion between, say, 2001, 2011. So do you think this sort of immigrant religiosity is in some ways going to be an important force in terms of countervailing that decline of religion in the West?
Yeah, it certainly makes sense that that it would be. We see this in the United States, have seen this historically in the United States in terms of the Catholic population, where the influx of Catholics from Latin America has provided stability for the size and vitality of the U.S. Catholic Church. And likewise, it makes sense that here in Britain, an influx of people from Africa, from Asia, would increase the otherwise low levels of religiosity of the white native population.
Right, so kind of potential there for a sort of desecularization due to religious demography. I mean, do you want to talk about that? I mean, I know this is a hobby horse of mine in one of my previous books, but just perhaps give us the global picture on what's going on.
Well, one thing that you said strikes me, makes me remember is there was this paper long ago about Utah that suggested the high religiosity of Mormons in Utah was kind of rubbing off on everybody else. I did some analysis and didn't find that. But what I'm wondering about in the London context is whether you think that this high religiosity of immigrants is rubbing off in terms of the religiosity, not just the identity, of other people in London. I don't know. I would think probably not, but
I think
is that something you've
looked really
at?
There's really limited evidence, but I think from what I've seen, there is a small positive effect mm-hmm. that because you have so much religious immigration and such a vital religious scene, that it simply increases religious supply to such an extent that the interested white Brit can find a church that's lively.
Okay.
So
yeah,
I think there's a
sure.
small, it's in the small single digits in
okay.
terms of increase, but
okay.
it appears in the work that I did. I think I looked at the citizenship surveys, which is about
okay.
15,000. It's quite
mm-hmm.
large.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed to show a small effect there.
Okay, that's interesting.
But anyhow, I just want to sort of change gears to look
sure.
at the picture in the U.S., which, as we know, is currently undergoing almost unprecedented religious decline. Particularly, Charles Murray talks about the white working class drop in religious attendance in particular. What's your sense of what's going on in the U.S. in terms of the religious picture there?
It's definitely the case that the share of people who identify with no religion is steadily rising. It's particularly high among younger Americans. And for a long time, there was a sense that the U.S. was exceptional, that Europe was secularizing, but that that didn't affect the U.S. And now it's clear that the U.S. is indeed experiencing this decline in identity and declines in attendance, perhaps as well. But it's just happening at a lagged schedule behind what has happened in Western Europe. Now, there's some debate about whether there's been decline in the core religious population or not. And so David Vos and Mark Shaves have a paper basically saying that every subsequent generation in the U.S. gets less religious. And then there's a couple of folks who are arguing, well, on the other hand, it seems like the core is pretty stable, and it's just people who have kind of a nominal or moderate religious identity who are kind of drifting away and increasingly saying they have no religion.
And so, for example, for a long time, the orthodoxy was that the sort of conservative sects, fundamentalists, what were classed as fundamentalists, are retaining much better than the mainline, more liberal denominations. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, are the fundamentalists and evangelicals keeping their numbers, or are they also succumbing to this decline?
Well, the official Southern Baptist numbers have been declining for some time, but those numbers were notoriously inflated, that is, the denomination's own numbers. The funny thing about religious identity is that numbers vary a lot depending on what the incentive structures are. So in those ecclesiastical systems where congregations pay taxes to the larger denomination based on their numbers, they do a better job of kind of purging them. And on the other hand, when churches have incentives to not take people off the rolls, they tend to have larger numbers, and that has been the case in the Southern Baptist Convention. In any case, there probably has been real numerical decline in that evangelical body. There's definitely been large decline in mainline liberal denominations like the Presbyterian Church USA. On the other hand, the Assemblies of God has been growing significantly. That's a more Pentecostal denomination that draws on a lot of immigrants. And so it kind of varies depending on which of these particular groups you look at.
And do you have any, I mean, I don't know whether this data exists, but do you know whether, so what we see in London with this immigrant religiosity boosting, you know, countering secularization, mm-hmm. do we have evidence of that in the U.S. case where immigrants are making places more religious? I'm not sure that you'd have that data because it's very low scale.
Yeah, I'm sure that is the case in right. some particular communities and definitely in individual congregations. So you may have right. Catholic parishes, again, where the historic population is kind of withering, and then there may be a separate service on Sunday afternoon that's a Hispanic service right. or some other immigrant group, and that could be a growing, very vital population.
Okay. So in terms, and your just in terms of the Christian right, I mean, we know Trump in a way represents, I would argue, to some degree, the decline of the Christian right influence on the Republican Party. I don't know what you think of this. I mean, what's going on with the Christian right in terms of its influence? Am I right to see it as having declined substantially?
There's a lot of debate about this in the U.S., and people who are in the evangelical world and critical of Trump have made the argument in the past that those people who support Trump, they're not really evangelical, they're not church-going evangelicals. The analysis my colleagues at Pew have done has found that evangelical support for Trump was as strong or stronger as it was for Romney or Bush or any other recent Republican presidential candidate and eventually president. So, you know, generally, evangelicals have been and continue to be quite supportive of Trump.
But in terms of, I mean, certainly the evangelical elite and its influence in the RNC, for example, which is sort of on the out. It's, I mean, in terms of the elite levels, the policy-making levels, I agree with you, the base of parishioners seems to very much have gone with Trump. But just in terms of that sort of elite-level influence, do you see anything, their influence, am I right to see their influence weaker in under Trump than it was, say, under Bush?
I'm probably not the person to comment on that. I'm not sure. That's an interesting question.
Right.
I mean, we certainly see Jerry Falwell Jr., for example, being a very prominent supporter of the president, and he has some evangelical advisors who have been, again, very vocal in their support for him, but whether they're actually influencing his policies, I don't know. They seem pleased with the Supreme Court picks and some particular policies of the Trump administration.
Right. Okay. Now, and then... Well, we can actually. I may just ask you about that, the support base, and what, because people will sometimes ask, you know, why are evangelicals supporting Trump? And I always explained it in terms of identity rather than theology, and that it's more about it's part of kind of defensive, almost ethnic majority identity that's associated with a particular version of American identity, which they feel is perhaps under threat or under attack in some way. What's your read, or do you not have a read, on the reason for the strong support of evangelicals for Trump?
I think people tend to be more forgiving of the flaws in a president's character when that person is part of their own party. So there's a viral video going around Twitter right now that contrasts things that Fox News said when President or candidate Obama proposed talking to North Korea's leader versus how they're interpreting the boldness and braveness of right. in their words, of President Trump doing the same things. And it's a very different perspective. And the implied criticism is that there's kind of different standards depending on who the party is. And I think people are like this. You know, we just have a little different standards depending on whether it's our candidate or the other candidate. So I think that's probably the kind of dynamic that's at play here.
Right. Yeah, it's also interesting. It seems to me, from what I can see, Latino evangelicals went heavily for Trump as well, or significantly for Trump, which I think is interesting. But anyway, another pet hobby of ours, the LDS, or the Mormon Church. What are your views on the Mormon Church? I mean, we've seen a paper from Lyman Stone who's claiming that the Mormons' traditional fertility advantage may be eroding. So they've traditionally had about one child more, a little over one child more on average than the rest of the U.S. population. I mean, what's your view on that? Do you think that's changing in any way? Or what do you make of his argument?
Well, what I've seen in terms of data on Mormons is that they're influenced by the same forces that influence everyone else in America, but they're always still having higher fertility. So, yes, their fertility has been declining, but it's higher. So Utah, which has a majority Muslim population, still leads the United States in fertility numbers. And the latest numbers from the CDC show that I think only Utah and South Dakota have above replacement level fertility.
So
LDS numbers may be going down. Part of that may be the effect of young women being eligible to go on Mormon missions and delaying their fertility a little bit as a result of that. And some have argued that maybe when they go out in the world and see new places that it affects their fertility desires. In my own research that you referred to earlier, one thing I found was that the experience of being active in a congregation and the support that you can get there tends to raise fertility for people of all backgrounds compared to otherwise similar women with the same education, for example, in the same community. So people who are active in the Latter-day Saints community, they're worshiping with other large families, they've got strong support networks, and I think that will boost their fertility in the face of the pressures they're exposed to that other people face, you know, the cost of living, importance of education, and so forth. The fascinating thing to me is that the Mormon Church both encourages women to get as much education as they can and also to have as many children as they can. And that's an unusual mix. A lot of times the denominations or religions that encourage high fertility don't also encourage women to get as much education as possible.
Yeah, that is a highly unusual. The other, I think, a highly unusual stat is the sort of wealthier Mormons tend to have more kids, which is kind of one of those interesting anomalies. But so the long and the short of it is, I mean, we don't really see that much change in the dynamic, which would tend to be leading to a increased share, let's say, of the U.S. that is Mormon, even though that's a very small share because there's only 6 million Mormons. But that doesn't. We don't. I'm not convinced that this trajectory has changed very much. What about this? I mean, it kind of brings us nicely into this question of what's been going on with just fertility rates in general in Europe and the United States. I don't know if you want to comment on this since 2007-8. I mean, what's your view on this decline?
Well, we have seen declining fertility rates in the United States and some European countries. And there are definitely people who are alarmed by this. What's striking to me is the new numbers that just came out from the United Nations, where they're looking in the long term about global numbers. And the thing that really popped for me is they project Africa will have 3 billion more people by the end of the century than it has currently. So by contrast, Asia is the world's largest religion with a little bit more than 4 billion people currently. They project that in 2100, Asia will have about the same number of people as it has today, while Africa grows from about 1.3 billion today to 4.3 billion by the end of the century.
Right, which will have huge implications. I mean, I'm thinking of a country like South Africa, which of course has land borders, which are going to be harder to defend, and has a very low black fertility rate of only about replacement. And I'm just wondering what, presumably the migration pressures on those land borders are going to be quite significant. I mean, this is probably an area of speculation for you, but have you guys thought about this?
Well, with 3 billion people being added to the continent, that's going to add a lot of challenges in terms of an opportunity, too, in terms of that's a lot of people added to the workforce. And around the world, we have so many countries where population decline is expected. And so there's an opportunity to draw on Africa's growing population for future workers. But on the other hand, it could be a cultural challenge if within Africa and from Africa to other regions, there are large flows of people. And, you know, climate change is going to be another challenge. So if Bangladesh is increasingly underwater, you know, those people are, large populations going to have to go somewhere.
Right, right. Yeah, this will be a key issue. Although as somebody who's looked in the political demography research, there's a lot of skepticism around the sort of climate change conflict nexus, and I sort of think that's justified, but, I mean, climate change is happening, it's real, it's more the question of will it lead to these downstream effects, which I think it's an open question, but I do agree with you, the African situation will be a big challenge, and, you know, presumably, large expansion of cities will be a major outcome of that.
Sure.
But I think if we look at, say, South Africa's response to even roughly 5-6% foreign-born, I mean, there's been pogroms and riots and things. It doesn't bode well to how that country's going to deal with what might be greater pressures on its borders in the future. Well, let's turn to Latin America, because I wanted to pick your brains about the recent trends there, particularly, I mean, we've known about the Pentecostal revival or growth of Pentecostalism in Latin America for some time, but this rise of the non-religious, the secularization, it seems to me that's new. It wasn't being talked about as much, say, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. What are your thoughts on what's going on with secularization in Latin America?
Well, first of all, in terms of religious identity, the country that has and has had the largest share of people who don't identify with religion is not the U.S. in the Americas. It's not the United States or Canada. It's Uruguay. So for some time, Uruguay's had about 40% of the population that says they don't have a religion. They're largely influenced by French culture and laicite.
Okay.
In other Latin American countries, there have been, to different degrees, kind of a rise in the share of people who don't identify with religion. You sent me an excerpt of some numbers from Latino.
I just want to read that out because it says, this is from a piece by Andrew Chestnut. It says, the most significant new development on the Latin American religious landscape is the meteoric rise of the religious nuns, those who don't have any specific religious affiliation. The 2014 Pew survey, that's you guys, reported a Latin American population of 8% nuns, and according to the Latino Barometro, which I suspect is a smaller sample size, but still says that in 3 years it's now more than doubled to 17%. What's your sense of that? Is that a reliable number?
Well, I haven't seen that survey.
Okay.
I suspect that it is the case that the share of people who don't identify with religion is increasing in Latin America. But as is the case in Europe, measuring identity can be tricky in places where you have people who, depending on how you ask the question, might or might not identify with religion. And so sometimes what can happen is if we compare surveys that have different questions, we can unintentionally exaggerate the magnitude of the change that's taking place.
Okay.
And I think in terms of those, that's what I'd be wary of in that terms of that comparison. I wouldn't want to misstate meteoric growth for what might actually be just differences in question wording.
Okay. Well, that's a good answer. I was actually going to circle back to, again, to frame this integration debate in Europe around the source countries, perhaps for future immigrants, and look at Middle East, Africa, and just talk us through maybe some of the religious and demographic trends. I mean, first of all, in the Middle East, there was talk of the Arab baby bust, I'm trying to remember where that paper came out, but essentially a big drop in fertility rates in the Arab world. Is that something that you think is continuing, and are those fertility rates coming down to replacement level?
That's a great question. Okay. So there was work 10 or 15 years ago that pointed out what a huge decline Iran had in terms of fertility rates, right, and that other countries in North Africa and the Middle East were experiencing relatively big drops. That in recent years with the Arab Spring, I think in Egypt, they actually saw an increase in fertility following the Arab Spring. I don't think that's a huge change necessarily, but we talked a minute ago about Africa's expected growth. And part of the story in Africa is that countries in sub-Saharan Africa have not experienced the rate of fertility decline that was expected. So places like Niger, Mali, still have very high fertility numbers. And there are some observers like Rodney Stark who have read that paper by Nick Eberstadt and colleagues and said, well, if Iran is having this decline in fertility, then surely it's happening in every Muslim country. And the projections that the Pew Research Center has made, he's been skeptical of that. But in fact, our work is based on analyzing the data from each country and looking at the UN's projections for those countries. And basically, sub-Saharan Africa is not yet following the Iran lead, for example.
And is there much? I had heard that there used to be no difference in the Muslim-Christian fertility rate in Africa, and now there is. Is that something that you guys have picked up at all?
I'm not sure where you heard there wasn't a difference. Maybe that was true in some countries, but in general, it's high for both Muslims and Christians. It's higher for Muslims.
Right.
So in a country like Nigeria, you might have Muslim women having 6 children and Christian women having 4 children. High, but with that kind of a fertility differential.
So it's that large a gap.
That's roughly the magnitude in Nigeria, I remember correctly. And similarly, in other African countries, fertility is way above replacement in many countries for Christians and Muslims, but Muslims are growing faster.
Okay, and so that then leads us to your global projections. Talk us through maybe how the size of the different religions is changing in the world.
Sure. Today, Christians are about 31% of the world's population. They're the largest group. Muslims are 24%. So they're in second place. Right. So Christians are, in terms of babies, Christians are having more children than any other religion. But we project that in about 15 years, there'll be more babies born to Muslim women than to Christian women because of the combination of high fertility rates and also that because of high fertility rates in the past, there are more young Muslim women of childbearing age than there are as a share of the population
right.
than of any other right. religious group.
So the trajectory is one of becoming the number one religion. When would be the crossover, roughly the crossover?
So if things continue as they have been, then by
right.
about 2075,
right.
we would anticipate that Muslims could be the largest religious group in the world.
And what about the nuns, the sort of no religion group? Because there is an assumption that that's a growing
yes.
group. Is it really growing?
Well, it is in a lot of countries, Western advanced economy countries like the UK, other Western European countries, Australia, New Zealand, the US, Canada. However, by our count, the largest populations of people who don't identify with religion are in China and Japan. And those are countries that are aging and not experiencing population growth. And even the countries like the UK, where nuns are increasing as a share of the population, the overall population is not growing quickly. And then you think back to Africa, with 3 billion people expected to be added by the turn of the century. And it's not clear that the number of nuns is increasing in Africa, but for sure the number of Christians and Muslims is increasing dramatically. And so we project that while there will probably be a little bit of increase in the number of people who identify as nuns globally, the share of people globally who identify with no religion could decline from about 16% today to perhaps 13% by 2050.
So the world is actually desecularizing, to put it, using the term secularism quite crudely, at a global level, we're seeing actually the world's going to become more religious, say, by 2050 than it is today, according to the numbers.
Yeah, in the sense that we would expect more people to have a religious identity
right.
globally, just because of the concentration of where people live.
Right.
That's right.
Okay. So,
As you have argued in
right,
your own book.
Right, yes, but I it's interesting to hear it from you too. But,
right.
but okay, I think we've covered a lot of the ground that I want to cover. Just in terms of, maybe we can take that as a jumping off point mm-hmm. for talking about the argument for secularization. So the Norris Inglehart argument that the world will eventually see a shift to declining religion,
mm-hmm.
and the world will move in a secular direction. I mean, are there any scenarios under which you could see that their thesis coming true?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts on this. So first of all, I'm really interested in what's going to happen in India and in Muslim-majority countries where currently there's just not a significant population that identifies with no religion. In a lot of Muslim-majority countries, like Egypt, when you're asked on the census, what is your religion? There's no option to say, I have no religion. You can be Christian, Muslim, Jewish.
Right.
I think they may have recently talked about adding an other category. But there's not a choice to say, I have no religion. So that's one issue. But it's not clear that the same kind of secularization as it exists in Western Europe, you know, is that going to happen in India or the Muslim world? I don't know.
Because we don't see any non-Christian religious dominated country, at least that I'm aware of, if we leave East Asia aside, that has this pattern of religious loss. And that seems to be my impression, that we have it a bit in Latin America, which is Christian, and we have it in the West. We have it a bit, or we had it a bit in Israel. But are there any countries that would be exceptional or exceptions to that?
Well, I think you said you wanted to leave aside Asia. So Asia,
what
religion looks like, identity and practice, is a little harder to measure in East Asia. So Japan, you know, maybe. I mean, Japan's a country where people say they have no religion, but then they may have a statue of Buddha that they revere, and they may do religious things, but say they're not religious. the thing that editor at Science Magazine asked us when we submitted a paper with our projections for the population of people who have no identity was, what difference does it make? Like, you know, we put a lot of energy, obviously, into counting who identifies with religion or not. But this editor, who maybe is not a religious person himself, wanted to know, why should anybody care? And as somebody who studies religion, my first thought was, oh, of course it's important. That's why I spend all this energy doing it. But as I thought about it more, I realized a lot of our research on religion is about how people who are active in religious communities are different in terms of health and well-being and civic participation from people who are not active. And we know there's some people who have a religious identity but aren't active in communities. So I wondered, what do we know about how British society, for example, might be different if more of those people who have kind of a what could be described as a nominal identity shift to not identifying with religion? And so to consider this, we looked at survey data from a couple dozen countries where we could compare on outcomes like health, happiness, civic participation, the differences between people who were religiously active, who had an identity but were inactive, and those who were religious nones. And we found, as expected, that there were distinctives among people who are religiously active. They tended to vote in national elections more and being part of organizations more, more likely to be happy. The health effects were not quite as clear. But between the people who were religiously inactive and the nones, we actually didn't find a lot of difference, especially after we controlled for age and some other compositional characteristics. So right. To the question of the science editor's question of, you know, how does it matter? Our conclusion was that what will probably be more consequential for society is if there's a decline in the kind of core religious population who are actually active in communities, and it might not be as consequential if we just see a shift between the population who doesn't identify with religion versus identifying but having a marginal commitment.
So in a way, you're talking about things that perhaps Charles Murray in his book Coming Apart talked about a little bit, this idea that the rise in suicide and opioid use and all this is connected somehow to the white working class religious decline in America. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that, on his argument? Or?
I haven't looked at that in detail, so I'm not sure.
Right. It's an interesting argument to consider. I know some people would just say, well, that social capital has gone elsewhere from religion to mm-hmm. other forms of voluntary association. Yeah. But yeah, it's a debate.
I mean, the thing that's unique about religious activity is that such a large share, in the United States anyway, of people have been involved in religious communities. And so bowling leagues or soccer teams or, you know, the Kiwanis, Rotary, those kind of clubs, they may be really meaningful for the people who participate, but the share of Americans who are part of those kind of groups is much, much lower than it is
right.
for religious groups.
Right, okay. Well, maybe we'll wrap it up by talking about the Holy Land for a second.
Okay.
Because what are your thoughts just on what's happening in Israel? Israel is an exception in so many different ways, but first of all, what's the sort of headline numbers on religion in Israel? Are we expecting a continued rise in conservative religiosity there?
Well, certainly the conservative Jews have higher fertility, and so in terms of demography is a big thing, and people even talk about sort of political demography of fertility. In the Palestinian territories, something that's really unique is that highly educated Muslim women have much higher fertility than is the case in other places.
But declining, apparently. I don't know. Apparently the fertility rate in West Bank and Gaza has come down, say, significantly in the last 10 years. I don't know what you're
saying. That could be. I haven't looked at those numbers recently, so I'm not abreast
right.
of the very latest developments. So we're looking forward to updating all of our religious demography work with the upcoming 2020 census wave. And so we'll be revisiting all of our work, and if we talk again in a couple of years, I'll know all the latest numbers.
So we can expect when's the next major Pew report on religion in Europe or worldwide?
Well, it may take us a little while. Unfortunately, countries differ in terms of the actual year they collect census data. So it would be 2021 here in Britain. In India, their 2011 census data on religion didn't become available until 2015. So we have to wait a little bit for countries to release the data.
Okay.
So I don't have a date to promise you yet, but it will be coming.
All right, Conrad. Well, thanks. This has been great. And all the best with the rest of your European trip.
All right. Nice talking to you, Eric.
Good to talk to you. Bye.
Thanks.